You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson and coming up in today's programme, Brexit talks begin in earnest. The two sides sit down for the first serious day spent unpicking the stitches that bind the UK to the EU. Also ahead, relations in the Middle East go from bad to worse as the UAE is accused of and denies hacking Qatar's news agency. Plus,
in a way, forest has you to be more humble, and the nature is strong, you know. So in this project, I wanted to make a kind of statement also, because I want this piece to be the beginning of something for this town.
We head to the Biennale of Design in Ljubljana in a preview of our design show, Section D. All that, plus the erosion of democracy in Poland and the Asian newspapers too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24. But first, a quick look at the day's other stories. Russia's demanding the immediate return of diplomatic property seized by the Obama administration after claims Moscow hacked the US election. The Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has described the move as daylight robbery. Venezuela's opposition calls for a national strike against President Nicolas Maduro in an escalation of protests after a massive symbolic referendum at the weekend. More than 7 million voters were believed to have taken part in the referendum. Venezuela's been polarised between backers and opponents of President Maduro. A 20-year-old man has been arrested in Israel after flying a drone close to planes as they were landing in Tel Aviv. The man was held after he posted footage online. Israel's transport ministry has described it as a disturbing and serious incident. And Winnie the Pooh has been censored from Chinese social media. No official explanation has been given, but it's thought it's because bloggers have been comparing the fictional bear to China's president. Xi Jinping's appearance is deemed sensitive ahead of the upcoming Communist Party Congress. And those are the headlines. 23:02 in Brussels, 22:02 here in London, and a warm welcome to Studio One. We begin the Monocle Daily with Brexit. Day two of the talks and the UK looked as ill-prepared as ever. Well, at least they did in the pictures, because the negotiators on the EU side of the funny metal table have big wads of notes next to them. Only Ollie Robbins on the British side has a slim notebook, and it was closed. But it was David Davis who safely back off the Eurostar on the British side tonight, who's called on both sides to get down to business. But what could be achieved in one day? Well, Ryan Heath is senior EU correspondent at Politico, and he joins me now on the Monocle Daily. Ryan, welcome as ever to the programme. Before we get down to the nuts and bolts of the of what was said and what may or may not have been achieved today, I was struck by just how dull the negotiating room was and how it didn't seem to have any windows and seemed to be the most, it was almost as if the United Kingdom had been shoved into a side room.
Indeed. I think one of the pictures you may have been seeing was from the private offices of Barnier, and they're actually negotiating in a bigger room lower down in the Commission's Berlaymont headquarters, but it also doesn't really have any natural light. So whatever pictures your listeners were seeing, it fairly reflects how dull this whole process is going to be, and I think we're in for a long 2 years, frankly.
And it was, well, less than 2 years, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on whose side you're taking. What also struck me is that, yes, the British side seemed completely ill-prepared. If you look at Michel Barnier and the two women who flank him, they both have very neat piles of papers. It just looks as if the Brexiteers have just turned up and it's like a pub chat, apart from Ollie Robbins, who by all accounts is the brains behind all this, who has a small A5 notebook. I mean, was there any indication that the British weren't necessarily that prepared today? Because even David Davis stayed for less than an hour and then he had to come back to London.
Indeed, these optics are terrible. And if they were just optics, then maybe we could presume there was some deeper strategy and not worry about it so much. But it really tallies with a bunch of other evidence we've been collecting over months here on the Brussels side of the debate. And that ranges from British figures, whether they're civil servants or MPs turning up in Berlin and essentially almost offending the Germans they were meeting with their lack of preparation, and through to the fact that Davis exited essentially as quickly as he had turned up. And you have to wonder what more important tasks he has on his agenda if not to run the Brexit negotiations that he was appointed
to negotiate. Well, you say that, but actually from the point of view here in the United Kingdom, the mood music that is coming from the government is very much a need for the Conservative Party to take control of itself, not least the country. And one wonders whether that is a mood music which is purveying right through the British side of the negotiations, that people are more concerned with shoring up the Conservative Party than they are with dealing with the United Kingdom's long-term future. Does any of that suggestion ring true with what you've been hearing where you are?
Yes, that message definitely filters down into Brussels. And I think that people in Brussels not only hear it in the present tense, they hear it in the past tense as well. They feel like this is almost the third occasion that internal Conservative Party fighting might be severely disrupting the arrangements of the European Union. Now, of course, the UK's sovereign right is to go through this process, but it does feel as if problems inside the Tory party have been projected into a much bigger scale with unknown consequences.
So explain to us a little bit about what may or may not have actually been achieved today.
Well, today they did have a working group meeting on the financial settlement issue. And frankly, everyone who was in that room is being very tight-lipped. I think that's the consensus amongst the journalists who have been trying to follow it. But we know that the EU side has been getting very frustrated because the UK hasn't, at this point, really gone into any detail about what financial bill it might be prepared to accept. Now, that bill is interpreted as something punitive by many Brexit campaigners, but essentially it's composed of different things. One level is simply the UK's legal obligations, things that it was signed up to and essentially had bought in advance. Another element of it is what the UK might wish to be involved in the future, and you need to kind of decide in the between now and 2019 whether you want to commit to some of those things in the future. And then there are other things like should the British government pay for the pensions of British officials who are working inside the EU even after the UK has gone. And there hasn't really been any progress on the UK saying what it would be willing to pay out of that list of demands. And Michel Barnier, the EU negotiator, we understand, our EU diplomats that we've been talking to, say that he's willing to issue a warning tomorrow that if the UK isn't prepared to get serious, then they might just have to not proceed with the negotiations until there's a rethink on the British side.
When they mean they're not taking it seriously, what exactly do they mean by that? I mean, you mentioned the fact that in Berlin there was a slight sort of shock at the paucity of preparation or preparedness that the British side were. But not being prepared and not taking it seriously can in fact be two different things.
And it's also a lack of knowledge at some level. I certainly would not accuse Oliver Robbins, Sir Tim Barrow, the ambassador here, people like Sir Jeremy Haywood, who is the cabinet secretary. I'm not saying that they lack knowledge. But I think if you go one layer deeper down, the people who are sort of politically steering the ship a lot of the time, they don't quite know how the EU works in detail. Now, you might say it's not their job to know that. But if you're going to take the UK down this very treacherous course, somebody has to know. Like, they really is a kind of obligation to study up and learn if you don't know. And I think that's the concern when you see it from a range of political actors on the continental side of the debate, is they really feel like the UK doesn't quite understand what it's doing to itself. And that obviously does get mixed up in the emotions of not wanting the UK to leave, people who would want to see a strong set of EU institutions or an EU federal state. So there's definitely a mingling of all of those facts and emotions. But the UK doesn't really do anything to dispel the idea that it hasn't got itself ready for this process.
Therefore, I mean, the way you sound as if it's down to two characters on the British side to actually steer the United Kingdom through the Brexit negotiations. Can it really be as dire as that?
I think it can be, and I think it's not a bad thing if David Davis is actually back on British shores tonight. Now, that sounds a bit sad and terrible, but I think the feeling here in Brussels is they'd rather, if not have, I don't know if you can label anything a fair negotiation, but they would rather have a functioning negotiation of evenly matched teams. And I think when you take David Davis out of the table, then you take Michel Barnier away from the table, and that mismatch between those two operators where Barnier has the advantage, you know, it kind of levels itself out again when the technocrats are put in charge. And that probably overall is a good thing for the progress of the negotiations.
The technocrats now take over tomorrow, don't they? Because David Davis, as we have said, only spent less than an hour glad handing Michel Barnier before he headed straight back to the Eurostar, leaving the likes of Oliver Robbins and the team to actually start to go off into side rooms and to really start to do the nitty-gritty of the negotiations. What is expected to happen tomorrow?
Well, they've got a schedule that sees them meeting, well, the leaders all get together, the people who are that top layer of the technocrats all try and set a strategy from 9:30 to 10 a.m. Brussels time. Then the first meeting is around the Irish issues until lunchtime. And then they talk about wider governance in the afternoon. And in parallel, like throughout that whole eight-hour process, there'll be the working group on citizens' rights and the financial settlement. And we're not really going to get any proper readout from any of it until tomorrow afternoon.
When you mentioned that, it suddenly hits home to at least these people on this side of the channel, the enormity of the task ahead and the fact that you've just reeled off four or five fundamental parts of the way that the United Kingdom and the European Union function together. And you're talking about splintering off working groups as if, I have no idea, as if you're sort of coming up with some sort of long-term raft debate for the future of the European Union. It's going to have to go at that rate, isn't it? Is there any sense that this is just too difficult to do?
There is, but people would rather not waste more time on that sense, essentially, in Brussels. They've been trying to say that for a year to wake up the British side. So now they just want to put their heads down and get on with it. And any one of those five issues I mentioned could count as some kind of identity crisis for a country that it might grapple with for years. And this is just the divorce half of the proceedings. What the UK has said it actually wants to do is really make sure it's negotiating the future relationship and considering them as two wings on the same plane before anything gets signed and sealed in 2019. And if you look at how hard it's going to get through just that divorce proceedings, it's almost inconceivable that the future relationship could be sorted out by 2019. And there will have to be some kind of transition or phased arrangement. And it might not be popular for someone like me to say that here in Brussels to a British audience, and it's not making Philip Hammond popular in the cabinet, but it's kind of a fundamental reality.
Ryan Heath, I think a lot of those are dawning on us here in the United Kingdom hard and fast. Ryan Heath is senior UK EU correspondent at Politico. Thanks for joining us on Monocle 24. It's 22:12 here in London. When in May, Qatar's state news agency posted incendiary quotes from the country's emir, the beginning of the current diplomatic crisis between Qatar and its neighbours was sparked. It was claimed that the emir praised Hamas and praised Iran. Well, 2 months on and Qatar has been ostracised culturally and economically. But now it's been claimed that the comments that so many nations found offensive were in fact posted onto the Qatari news agency's site by the UAE. The UAE denies the claims. Well, to try and unpick this, I'm joined in the studio by Lina Khatib, who's head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Lina. Thank you for joining us in the studio. Take us back to May when these quotes appeared on the Qatari news agency. What happened?
Well, what happened is that we saw a very extreme reaction from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, as well as a bit later on Egypt and Bahrain, all of them accusing Qatar of sponsoring terrorism and extremism.
And at the time, what did Qatar say?
Well, Qatar very strongly denied these accusations. It said it is not a sponsor of terrorism. It is not involved in any of the activities that the rest of the Gulf countries were accusing it of. And it said that this is an intervention in sovereignty.
Nonetheless, this is what prompted a large number of Middle Eastern countries, led by Saudi Arabia, to then take very, very punitive action against Qatar. There was obviously a sign that Qatar was not trusted by other members of the other member states in the Middle East. But what was it that actually made the Saudi Arabias, the Saudis, and the other groups think actually now we have to impose these sanctions? It wasn't just the news website, was it?
Well, of course, it wasn't the news website. It was actually an accumulation of activities on part of Qatar over the last, let's say, 20 years or so, ever since Qatar's foreign policy transformed into one about trying to become the new regional player to rival Saudi Arabia. So for the last 20 years, we've seen ups and downs in the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, because Saudi Arabia did not like this small country rising to try to basically take its place. And recently, Qatar's activities in Syria in particular, as well as in conflicts like the one in Libya, have been through supporting its key ally, the Muslim Brotherhood, that the UAE in particular regards as a key political threat, as well as supporting certain jihadist groups that Saudi Arabia did not like, even though we have to remember Saudi Arabia supported its own jihadist groups in Syria. So ultimately, this crisis is more about rivalry between Saudi Arabia and UAE on one side and Qatar on another side regarding who calls the shots in the Gulf.
And in the middle of this is the UAE. And it was claimed today by the Washington Post that US officials found out last week that ministers from the UAE held a meeting on the 23rd of May to discuss plans to hack Qatari government news and social media sites and to post incendiary false quotes attributed to Qatar's emir. What do you think had caused the UAE to jump from criticism to what is being accused of basically out-and-out sabotage of the country's mouthpiece?
If you look at UAE's foreign policy, you will see that over the last 3 years or so, UAE moved from a country that practically did not do much when it comes to politics, it was mostly involved in economic activities abroad, into a country that is very much an interventionist, that is involved in the anti-ISIS coalition airstrikes, that has hands-on engagement in places like Libya and Egypt. And this is all about UAE's own political ambitions. So what we're seeing now is just the result of the UAE feeling more and more empowered, especially that in the US, UAE sees in the new Trump administration a key ally that it could rely on. So now is the moment for UAE to assert itself.
Is there any indication that the UAE did not hack the Qatari website, that this is actually a made-up story?
All of this is speculation. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether a website was hacked or not. What matters is that we are seeing this power struggle between these entities in the Gulf, with Qatar being punished for having these ambitions and for crucially supporting the Muslim Brotherhood that the UAE regards as a destabilizing force, that the UAE sees as threatening its own interests abroad, especially in a place like Egypt, and therefore the Saudis and the Emiratis want Qatar to just toe their line when it comes to foreign policy.
What I find interesting about this story is the fact that the leak seems to have been made to the United States. And it has been suggested that the US was cross, was angry, frustrated that the UAE hadn't shown a greater willingness to compromise or to try to bring a peaceful conclusion to Qatar's ostracization, and that a decision had been made to actually make the UAE feel distinctly uncomfortable.
Well, actually, the relationship between the UAE and the US has never been better. There are personal relationships going on between, for example, the UAE ambassador to the United States and someone like Jared Kushner. Kushner is also on very good terms with the governor of Abu Dhabi. And therefore, the US may have in the beginning taken a bit of interest in this crisis and tried to play a bit of a mediation role, but it very quickly rolled back its engagement and said, you know what, this is an internal matter in the Gulf, let the Gulf countries sort it out themselves. And today at Chatham House, we hosted the UAE's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, and he did say that mediation in this crisis is through Gulf countries, mainly Kuwait and Oman, and not the US.
There's quite a lot of things that the UAE foreign minister said. It's Anwar Gargash who came to visit you at Chatham House today. And one of the things that he said was that we really do want to reach an agreement and Qatar's behaviour changes, or Qatar makes its own bed and they can move on and we can move on with a new relationship. One thing that he did warn, though, I mean, no matter what he agrees a new relationship to look like, he says that the Gulf cooperation could collapse rather than see other member states throw Qatar out. Is there anybody who is actually quietly trying to sing the praises of Qatar or warn the other countries not to completely cut ties?
Well, they weren't going to cut ties from the very beginning. He explained today that even the long list of demands on Qatar is only the starting point for negotiations. So even he very openly acknowledged that what is going on here is a process of putting pressure on Qatar to reach some form of compromise that would be acceptable to the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And therefore, it is highly unlikely that anybody is going to completely cut ties with Qatar.
Lina Khatib, head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
As the main players in the EU speak of more reform, closer integration and further cooperation, Poland, it seems, is moving in the opposite direction. This weekend, the Parliament approved measures to allow the country's lawmakers to choose members of the judiciary. Critics say it undermines the democratic principle of the separation of powers. Well, I'm joined in the studio by Paweł Swiedlicki. He's a Brexit and EU analyst. A very warm welcome to the programme. And Paweł, you have a close connection to Poland as well. Explain to us what exactly has been happening in Poland this weekend. We've seen pictures of protests, but this is the culmination of several months, if not more than a year, of a gradual erosion of democracy by those in power in Warsaw.
Exactly. So what's happened is that the government, Law and Justice, won the elections in late 2015, and since then they've set about consolidating their hold on power by taking over the main institutions, the judiciary. And what we saw this weekend was the most recent development on that front, but also other institutions, the state security services, the public media, any organisations which span the public and private sector in Poland, so state utilities. All these organisations have essentially come under the control of the government in a way that is not really that would not be acceptable in many other countries.
Well, it wouldn't have been acceptable in Poland about 3 years ago either, would it? It's one of these things that seems to have visited Poland at the surprise of everybody else, not least the European Union. And then we see this weekend this decision to allow the judiciary to be chosen by the lawmakers, which is a fundamental breach of the separation of powers, not to mention the rule of law. I mean, it seems as if everything's crept up on us very quickly.
Exactly. And I think this is both to do with very specific very uniquely Polish circumstances, but also it can't be separated from what's happening in the out in the wider world.
Now, what do you mean by uniquely Polish?
So this very much has its roots in the struggle against communism and the way that the anti-communist opposition split after the fall of communism, and you have the camp under the former president Lech Wałęsa, which is seen as being the more pro-Western, pro-liberal side, and then you have the more nationalist camp, which are represented by the current government, which very much see their roots as going back to the nationalist parties that were around in the 1920s and 30s. So in that sense, it's a very unique Polish struggle, which has been going on for decades. But I think it's also very important to remember the international context. We have increasing authoritarianism around the world. I think in Europe, Hungary very much set the trend. Law and Justice and their leader Jarosław Kaczyński are very open that they see Hungary as a model to emulate when it comes to this to these nationalist politics and taking over state institutions in the name of the people. But also, this isn't a uniquely central or Eastern European phenomenon. I mean, we look at what's happening in the US, where we have Donald Trump. And to some extent, there are some parallels in the way that in the sort of policies that he's pursuing, not only the rhetoric, but the actual nature of the policies themselves. And certainly his visit to Poland the other week, where the government promised him cheering crowds, I think that has very much emboldened the government to act this way, because it's harder now to make the case that they have no allies, that they are isolated, because they can point to the support of Donald Trump.
And who would be proud of that? But there we go. Let's find friends where we can. It's that situation that you make the direct comparison between Poland and the United States, but perhaps the big difference is the overarching umbrella of the European Union. The European Union cannot be seen to be tolerating any sort of movement away from the great democratic principles upon which the European Union actually bases its very existence. Now, the EU can, sue Poland. What else can it do to try to dissuade the Polish government from taking an ever more nationalistic right-wing approach?
Well, this is a big irony that if the Polish government was doing now... I should say, if the Polish government had done what it is doing now when it was a candidate country, then it probably wouldn't have been allowed into the EU in the first place. But the problem is that once countries are in, they're essentially expected to behave. There aren't really those mechanisms for control. There is a so-called nuclear option, which is to strip a member state of its voting rights. The only problem is that all other member states have to agree. So not only does Poland have support in the form of Hungary, and in turn Poland itself is able to support Hungary, so the two countries can support each other, even some of the other member states, I think, would be wary of setting that precedent, because it would be a very aggressive move, much more so than anything that the EU has ever done before. I think Austria was sanctioned when Jörg Haider briefly entered the Austrian government, but that in comparison was over relatively quickly, and that was a lower order of sanction mechanism to the one that's now been put in place. So essentially what I'm saying is that unless everyone else in the EU can agree, there is little formal way of reprimanding a member state such as Poland, which veers off so radically from the path of the rule of law.
So any kind of opposition to this, which will have any medium to long term and direct effect, has to come from within Poland, you would argue. But who
Yes.
is the opposition, and how strong enough is it to take on Law and Justice?
I'll come on to that in one second. I would just say there are things that the EU can do. For example, it can obviously, Poland is a big recipient of EU funds, and so the EU does have some leverage in that area. The problem is that because its policies on managing the refugee and migration crisis is so unpopular, the Polish government is able to say, look, we're being blackmailed. They're trying to take our money. So it cannot be the case that the solution is imposed externally. That can be part of the factor, but I think you're right to say that it has to come from within Poland. And there have been some issues on which Poland has managed to come together and push back against the government. And I think the abortion changes, the planned abortion changes, where there was the so-called black protest, which gathered quite a lot of international coverage, was one example where actually the government backed down. I think the government's calculation in this regard is that this is much more of a niche issue. People don't, you know, people might not like politicians, but they don't particularly like judges either. They're seen as being a bit elitist and out of touch. So if the government can make the argument that they're corrupt and that they need to be purged, then there will be enough public support for such a radical course of action, and that the protesters will be relatively... there'll be a more of an issue of niche concern.
Paweł Swiedlicki, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. It's 6:30 a.m. in Seoul, 22:30 here in London. South Korea has offered to hold talks with Pyongyang to ease animosities after weeks, if not years, of heightened tensions. It follows a precipitation of tension following the North's long-range missile tests. Well, there's been no immediate response by the North to the proposal, but let's hear now from Aidan Foster-Carter from Leeds University. He joins me now on the line. Welcome as ever to Monocle 24, Aidan. Explain to us what exactly has happened. What have the South Koreans said?
Well, this is Moon Jae-in, the still fairly new president of South Korea, elected just 2 months ago after the impeachment of his conservative predecessor, Park Geun-hye, who wanted really nothing much to do with the North, and that's what Moon Jae-in has inherited. He's of a very different kidney. He goes back to the Sunshine Policy, which I'm sure some listeners will remember. That was a decade ago, but before that it was the decade when two South Korean presidents decided to be nice to North Korea, more or less regardless of what North Korea did. That might be an exaggeration. But it's a lot of water has passed under the bridge since then, and basically Moon Jae-in's been trying to get the North to respond to anything very much. This is not the first. So I realize I'm not answering your question. I mean, what he's proposed this time is military talks. Well, that's one thing. Also, Red Cross talks about family reunions. But the latter also gives you some idea how difficult it is. The North has been saying recently, no more family reunions, which, of course, these are sort of very tragic situations of now very elderly people who last saw their relatives on the other side before the Korean War more than 60 years ago. No, none of those, but until they send back some people who defected, who the North says were kidnapped, and they weren't. Military talks might be a better bet, because that's something the Northern leader Kim Jong-un himself suggested at his big party congress, the first in many years, that was held a year ago. But there's no guarantee. I mean, Kim Jong-un, Sunshine was under his father, Kim Jong-il. Many Kims, you will know that. And he was, the North and South were getting along in those days moderately well. Didn't solve the nuclear issue and so on, but anyway, so we'll see. Will the North pick up the phone? I mean, that's quite a literal, because the way things are now, they've even suspended their military hotlines. It would be a start if they reconnected them.
Well, all this talk is wonderful, but is anyone going to pick up the phone, or is this exactly where Pyongyang wants Seoul to be?
I'm beginning to wonder, because perhaps, North Korea is kind of good at wrong-footing all of us. I mean, politicians and lowly analysts like myself alike, you just, when you think, well, you never quite think you've got their measure, but somehow I think a lot of us had assumed that, the big change was that South Korea had an election. Of course, you wouldn't catch that happening in the North, and, the right was out, the left were in, and we're going to have dialogue, as if, the North was the wrong assumption we had being that the North was kind of waiting to resume. Well, of course, the North had gone on high dudgeon under Park Geun-hye about how dreadful it was and how she wouldn't talk to them, and they certainly weren't going to talk to her, blah, blah. You'd think now they would have someone nice who would shower them with money. Moon Jae-in, over the years, he was the candidate of the Liberals last time, 5 years ago as well. He has a plan for a Korean Commonwealth, lots of aid, lots of trade. Difficult, of course, now under UN sanctions. But, he would want to do all that stuff. You'd think there is a phrase about looking a gift horse in the mouth, but it seems that Kim Jong-un would rather just go on and firing his ever bigger and better missiles and possibly, heaven help us, another nuclear test, which is a worry now, And he just is not going to pick up that phone. And then what does Moon Jae-in do? He's rather undermined.
What, therefore, is Seoul worried about? Yes, we have the obvious threat of an immediate and devastating military attack. But there are the long-term prospects of a reunification of South and North Korea, which many other countries are desperate for not to happen. How much does that become an influence in anybody's agreement or support or not of any talks between the two countries?
Quite honestly, not a lot. I mean, that would be the reunification, although in the Korean discourse sort of is the word which is Tongil in Korean is always used, where really, quite honestly, you know, it's very far down the road. We want to talk about reconciliation. What the real Moon agenda is, he wants South Korea back in the diplomatic game. I mean, one consequence, you know, you can argue hawk or dove on North Korea till you're blue in the face, but one consequence of the hawk line under Park Geun-hye and her predecessor, who was also Han Dae-myung-bak, is that basically you lose any influence in North Korea. You might say, well, we never had any anyway. And you basically follow what the Americans are doing. And no Koreans really like being puppets of any kind. So Moon Jae-in has been saying a lot about that South Korea should be in the driving seat, should be sort of running the diplomacy and not just sort of always a shrimp among whales, as the old Korean proverb has it. You'd think the North might be a little bit sympathetic to that, but there is still, you know, grave suspicions. And I think really beginning to wonder if the North isn't happier, just not, you know, sort of sitting in its own stew, I could use a ruder word, and just not talking to anybody, which is a rather grim prospect.
Aidan Foster-Carter from Leeds University, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. This week's edition of Monocle's Design Show Section D takes us to the Biennial of Design in Ljubljana. The French designer Matelli Cresset is known for her work with IKEA and the Italian furniture maker Pampeggi, as well as hotels in Paris to the Tunisian desert. But at Ljubljana's Design Biennial, she's taking the indoors outdoors for an exhibition called Occupying Woods. The results show what can happen when an interior and industrial designer applies her skills to a natural setting and the impact that can have on a local community. Monocle's Guy Delaunay went for a wander in the woods to find out more.
There's plenty that's weird and wonderful about Bio 25, the 25th edition of the world's longest running design biennial. But taking in the displays at Ljubljana's Museum of Architecture and Design won't even provide half the picture. There are seven so-called episodes of the biennial, projects directed by leading international designers, and six of them have major elements at far-flung sites around Slovenia.
So my project is in fact to do two types of community.
So when Matelli Cresset introduces her contribution at the museum, it's just the start of the journey. And where do we go from here? It's down to the woods, I fear.
I've just overheard somebody saying every design biennial should be held in the countryside. Well, we've come to the woods for this one. This episode is called Occupying Woods, and it's been directed by Matelli Cresset, and the centrepiece of it is a variation on a traditional ceramic wood-burning stove, this one installed in the middle of the forest.
In a way, forest has you to be more humble, and the nature is strong, you know. So in this project, I wanted to make a kind of statement also, because I want this piece to be the beginning of something for this town. So it has to be artistic, it has to be strong, and it has to be welcoming also, because my concern is about how making people interacting together.
The forest at Kačuje in southern Slovenia might not seem like the natural habitat for an interior or industrial designer, but Matelli Cresset has embraced the biennial's aim of celebrating the rural while using her experience of designing for hotels, furniture makers and IKEA. So a traditional ceramic stove is recast to resemble the head and upper body of a Minecraft character, welcoming local people to the woods.
I made a new typology because a stove at home is like a big block of furniture, and you are around the stove. And in this case, I just wanted the people to be in too, so I created like a small character who is in fact the protector of the community. And you can cook on the shoulder, you can cook the bread in the head, and share then after the tea or whatever in the arms.
This is situated actually in a forest that people use on a...
Yeah. We used to ball here to the dance and also to do picnic. So it's like a reactivation of a place. So people know, and there are people who do walks every day here. So it's nice to be like that nearby. In fact, the daily routine and just to invite them to stay a little bit longer on this structure.
Among the designers who are working here, people are probably most likely to buy your works or have your works in their home because of the work that you've done with Alessia and the work that you've done with IKEA. What do you get out of this as a designer when you're going back into your work for people like that?
I it gives me a lot of energy because I'm doing project for the people, in fact. So I'm not like thinking I may like this and maybe people will like also the same, but I never work like that. I really act for the people. So as soon as they are satisfied, I'm satisfied too. And it is a little bit my engine to do another project than after.
This isn't just an event for design aficionados. A large contingent of the Cachuya community is gathering around the stove in the forest. This area went through troubled times during the Second World War and for decades afterwards because of its ethnic German population. Mayor Vladimir Prebelich says the biennial project gives them a reason to feel proud.
I was really happy that this stove project, so-called, came into Cachuya, because what we really need is we have to open our minds, our eyes and everything that comes together, and to give opportunity to each other and to people who come from the other area. We try basically to start again and to build a trust between the people. And what is better to build trust on, like a stove that normally brings people together, because fire was from the ancient time factor that combined people, not to divide them.
This is a real example of design providing a solution for a problem in your community.
Yes, and this was important for us because, well, I am, let's say, old-fashioned in this way. I care about the culture and high art and so on, but, you know, from the mayor point of view, things should be useful. You know, things should bring something into society, should upgrade the society, and should be understandable for the society. So this is something that is not really high above the population. It's like I don't know, Picasso or something like that. You know, it's difficult to understand to the average people. This is something that really connects in any way the whole community as such. And I think this is the added value for all of us that we live in the area.
It turns out it was a friend of Monocle who was relishing the biennial's al fresco shenanigans. James Taylor Foster is the European editor-at-large for Arc Daily and impressed with what he's seen from Bio25.
What this biennale, from my reading, is trying to do is say that, look, design is everywhere. And never before, in sort of my understanding of these sort of events, has a biennale had the guts to attempt to do that. And, you know, for me, today we saw a stove built in the middle of a wood. And the designer introduced people from the mayor to project managers to a schoolmistress. And the picture was amazing because what it demonstrated was a real non-hierarchical, non-vertical relationship between someone from the outside and people who, as I said before, would never normally engage with this kind of discourse.
So occupying woods is a hit. But how will the doyens of design feel about the next biennial challenge to face them, which involves scrambling over rocks in a subterranean cavern at midnight? You'll have to join us next week to find out. For Monocle in Cachuya, I'm Guy Delaunay.
What a brave soul you are, Guy. That was Guy reporting from the Slovenian capital of Ljubljana. And for more design stories, tune into Section D tomorrow at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. This is Emma Nelson. And in a moment, we have the Asian papers. Stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
It's 5:44 a.m. if you're an early bird in Beijing, 22:44 here in London. Time now for a check of the Asian front pages. I'm delighted to say Sam Gill, executive editor of ChinaDialogue.net and associate fellow at Chatham House, joins me in the studio with a great array of stories to go through today. Welcome back, Sam. Everything from Chinese purging to Winnie the Pooh. Where do you want to begin?
So, well, if you look at the Straits Times today, and I suppose if you don't look at any of the Chinese newspapers, which won't really be covering this with any, at least certainly not giving any serious coverage beyond very terse kind of announcements, the big story is this political earthquake in Chongqing. As you say, what looks like a purge, the party boss of Chongqing has been replaced. He's a guy called Sun Zhengcai. He was a senior Chinese official who was really seen very widely as a contender for the top leadership. He's someone who was on track for promotion in the autumn to what's called the Standing Committee of the Politburo, which is this inner circle of seven sort of top leaders, with Xi Jinping being the only person kind of standing above them as the general secretary of the party. And this announcement that he will... that he's been put under investigation for serious discipline violations, a completely unspecified sort of charge as yet, means that he's going to be out of the Politburo in the autumn. And he's been replaced by a guy called Chen Min-er, who was already well known as a kind of protege of Xi Jinping's, having been his propaganda chief when he was party secretary in Zhejiang. So there's this interesting power play here, which is really about the longer term story of Xi Jinping's internal consolidation of power within the party. But it's a big deal in terms of leadership succession, because it was, you know, there's this question about whether any of the prior rules that China Watch has had subscribed to about the way that power and elite politics works in China still held. And this, again, is kind of suggesting to us that they don't. You know, Xi Jinping can actually take out people in a way that sort of flouts informal rules that people thought they'd understood.
Indeed. And when you came into the studio, I said, OK, on a scale of 1 to 10, how big is this purge? We are no stranger to the Chinese natural selection system being quite strictly engineered from the likes of Beijing. There's two issues here, isn't there? There's the perceived transgression of Sun Zhengcai, and there is also the... his replacement of a protege of Xi Jinping. Which do you think happened first?
It's a good question. I mean, actually, really, the place you start, in a funny way, if you're talking about this story, is way back in 2012, when you had the fall of this first round big Chongqing-based political earthquake, which was the fall of Bo Xilai. And that was the first time that really you saw Xi Jinping using anti-corruption. At the time, it seemed like this was just about Bo Xilai, was a very, you know, big upstart kind of leader who was challenging power. But it really was about the way that Xi Jinping could use the anti-corruption campaign as a way to purge the party of potential political rival sort of power bases. And I suppose that continues. And so here this is really a piece with that with that story. That he can continue really to make kind of earthquakes within the party by pulling out people who had been expected to be rising right to the top.
Let's move on to the Nikkei Asian Review. The headline is US may press China on steel as trade deadline passes. Both sides, it says, to discuss trade imbalance in upcoming economic talks.
So this looks like potentially, I mean, it's very unpredictable to really see what's ever going to happen when it comes to sort of White House economic policy, clearly, or foreign policy. But it looks like the US and China are heading for quite a heated confrontation, particularly over steel dumping. So as you may recall, Xi Jinping came to visit Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago in April. And they said they would agree an action plan by mid-July, 100 days hence, that would address their trade imbalances. That deadline has just passed. and these economic talks are coming up on Wednesday. And
who was the more aggrieved party in this? We were talking about perceived trade imbalances. Who's worse off or better off?
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to look at kind of trades in a very isolated way between two countries, then, you know, clearly the US run a deficit with China. But a lot of people would say, well, that's a fairly narrow way to view kind of the global economic system, which is all about all kinds of complex interdependencies. And besides, does the US really see its future in producing huge amounts more steel? Does it see it still competing with China? There's a lot of bigger questions here. But certainly, you know, there's been some small kind of concessions on either side. There was a dispute about beef was settled, or I think the groundwork for that was laid by Obama. There's been some kind of small things. But actually what it looks like is that there's not very strong grounds for very cooperative talks, and there's a lot of quite fierce words coming out of either side. And the expectation on the Trump side is that he's going for the kind of strong economic nationalist position favoured by people like Steve Bannon.
And there's also the issue of North Korea, which I think the United States has made no secret that it is happy to introduce into issues such as trade talks.
Yeah, and there was, of course, there was this very brief honeymoon between Trump and Xi Jinping after that meeting at Mar-a-Lago, where Trump seemed sort of thrilled about his new relationship and about the chocolate cake they ate and everything else. And then very quickly started tweeting, oh, well, you know, we thought they were getting serious about North Korea and they tried, but now they failed, you know, never mind. And apparently, you know, he was genuinely aggrieved. That was the reporting, that he really thought that he had sorted it all out and, you know, he hadn't. So I guess he's learning these things are more complicated.
Yes, when politics comes and smacks you hard across the face. Right, let's move on to people. And it says, Chinese shared bikes off to a bumpy start in global market. Goodness me, they took minutes over that headline. What does that mean? There's a picture of a man with a very handsome man on a very handsome bike with a very handsome dog in a bag on his back.
Yeah, this is from the People's Daily, the sort of state party-run sort of news organ. And the shared bike schemes like Mobike, which is pictured here on this story, and also there's a couple of competitors like Ofo, are absolutely ubiquitous in Chinese cities. They're really actually exciting bit of kind of disruptive innovation that these app-enabled bike sharing systems mean that actually you really you've seen cycling kind of come back in quite a big way in a lot of Chinese cities, which helps of course with air pollution, it helps with all kinds of transportation issues, and the innovation is really that you don't need to dock them, you can just leave them anywhere you like, you find them, you unlock them on the app. And there was some expectation that this quite innovative model that's taken off in Chinese cities would be exported overseas. And what this story is kind of giving very softly and rather kind of circuitous language is that it's not really, it's not going so well.
It's not
overseas.
Working, is it?
No, it doesn't see it. It seems like they tried to export it to Singapore, hasn't been popular. It cites here that it's very hot in Singapore. They already have very good public transportation. Doesn't seem like massive market for it. And then there's some kind of reference to the fact that actually people don't necessarily like the fact that these don't get locked in docks, which means they literally pile up in enormous piles outside subway stations and so on, and they litter the road. So actually there's some sort of teething troubles in moving this model outside. And it's a bigger question actually about all of these Chinese sharing apps, which was, there was a bit of a bubble around it, as it turns out.
And finally, we have but 1 minute to make direct comparisons, if we dare, between China's president and a bear of very little brain.
Well, yeah, this is actually illegal to make this comparison in China.
I'm reporting the news.
That's right. Apparently, if you now type in Winnie the Pooh into Chinese social networks, you get the message, this content is illegal. The reason is actually it stretches back to 2013 when Xi Jinping had his Sunnyland summit with Barack Obama, and there was a lovely picture of them walking together. Obama very kind of lean and tall and sort of lanky, and Xi Jinping rather sort of more portly, walking alongside him looking like Pooh and Tigger. And it seems that the Chinese sense have only really caught up with this. Now suddenly pictures and even just any mention of Winnie the Pooh and his Chinese translation is being abruptly censored.
Sam, thank you very much for joining us on The Monocle Daily. Finally, love them or hate them, horror movies are very big business. From the gory so-called torture porn franchises to the slightly more subtle jump-alongs that leave you wondering whether you really do need to nip to the toilet in the middle of the night, audiences across the world keep going back for more. Well, one of the genre's most visited themes is zombies, and although they might not be held in the highest regard, they may not have even happened had it not been for one man, George A. Romero. Monocle's Bill Luty has more.
Those that have studied film history, as I did very briefly at university, will be all too aware of those moments considered landmark. Professor Barbanfui and his crew landing in the eye of the man of the moon in Georges Méliès' A Trip to the Moon. The moment Al Jolson opens his mouth to sing for the first time on screen in 1927's The Jazz Singer.
Mammy. Mammy. The sunshine west.
And the rise of colour with films like The Wizard of Oz in 1939. But what about this? In October 1968, George A. Romero's debut film, and widely considered his greatest, Night of the Living Dead, was released to a world that couldn't have expected it less. Up until that point, people had been attacked by vampires, werewolves, the mentally ill, flocks of mildly irate birds, but never zombies. It was this unrelenting, unquenchable, unkillable creature, risen from the grave to feast on human flesh before moving on to find more, that captured the minds of audiences across the world and turned this $114,000 movie, still well under $1 million in today's money, into a cult classic that took almost 300 times that at the box office. Night of the Living Dead was important for a number of reasons. It proved that a decent filmmaker didn't need a decent budget to make a decent horror film, causing a wave of low-cost independent American exploitation films that got audiences by grabbing headlines. The sicker, more gruesome, gory a film, the more people it pulled. Some were outraged, but many were delighted. But Romero's genius lay less in his ability to splat some fake blood and weird prosthetic hoods over large numbers of zombified extras, and more in his not-so-subtle criticism, seething social commentary, and big old up-yours to the world he found himself living in the late 60s. Swap human brains for consumer items and picture hordes of mindless shoppers stumbling around malls, driven only by their thirst for more, and you'll quickly understand Romero's viewpoint. That I've come this far without mentioning any other Romero movie says much about Night of the Living Dead, a film that inspired 5 sequels, 2 remakes, and countless odes. Without Romero, some of the horror genre's finest moments might not have happened. Will Smith's chilling loneliness as the final survivor of a mysterious outbreak in I Am Legend. The cricket bat scene in the goriously funny Shaun of the Dead. And who could forget the underwater zombie punching a real-life shark directly in the face before munching on its brains. In Italy's finest, Zombies. Of course, all that set to a fine Italo-disco soundtrack. Twenty-eight days later, World War Z, Evil Dead. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that even Zombie Strippers, a film in which the strippers are,
believe it or not, zombies,
is actually an okay film, after a couple of beers. Although towards the end of his career, critics were less kind to George A. Romero's efforts behind the camera, his influence and legacy on the genre are undoubtable. After a short but aggressive battle with cancer, Romero died on Sunday night, surrounded by his family, listening to the soundtrack of one of his all-time favourite films, The Quiet Man. Here's to the man that turned Haitian folklore into one of the world's most overdone and underrated subgenres in film history. For Monocle, Hungry for Flesh, I'm Bill Luty.
And you think he's joking? Thanks, Bill. That's all we have time for today's programme. My thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, researchers Paige Reynolds and Maya Haygard, and our studio manager, Antonio Fernandes. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time with Tyke Enright kicking off events in Europe, and the Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.